Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report Look Ahead podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Joining us now is my dear friend, Byron Callen of the independent Washington research firm Capital Alpha Partners for a look at the week ahead and whatever else is on his mind. Byron, hope you guys had a very happy Easter weekend, and thanks so much for joining us.
We did, Vago, and these things are always too short, but it's nice to see the family and get everybody together.
Indeed, and it sort of marks this season, God willing, and pretty soon it'll be getting warmer than colder. Before we get started, a word from today's sponsor. Join HII at the Navy League's Sea Air Space Conference and Trade Show at the Gaylord National Convention Center outside Washington, D.C., April 8th through 10. HII is committed to delivering the platforms and technologies from aircraft carriers and Flight 3 destroyers to C5ISR and live virtual constructive solutions that create the advantage for their customers as they protect peace and freedom around the world. HII booth 1323. Byron, thanks very much again for joining us. A lot of fascinating notes, as always. Start us off with the April defense scorecard. And you noted that the supplemental is a main sector variable, right? So walk us through what all of that means and how the audience should be thinking about it, because folks really have been trying to dissect what's in the appropriations. Some things change, other things didn't change in terms of impacts. We've discussed that a little bit over the past couple of weeks. And now folks are really turning to the supplemental, given that it's not just Ukraine funding. It is Ukraine funding, but actually there's an enormous 90% of it is basically U.S. industrial base funding. Yeah. Walk us through the dynamics here.
So there's a little bit of breaking news element to this, Vago. You know, we're talking on Tuesday. On Sunday, you know, basically after the scorecard had kind of been put to bed, Speaker Johnson had come out and said that he, you know, wanted to bring the security supplemental to a House vote this coming week with some innovations. I shouldn't say this week, next week when the House is back in session. So right. Week of April 8th. You know, I think there's this question about, is he going to tie something related to liquid natural gas? You know, is there going to be a provision to provide loans to Ukraine, which, you know, got to wonder if those are ever going to get paid back. But if that's the metric that people want to, you know, kind of keep this as off balance sheet funding, basically, so, you know, some members of Congress can claim that it's not adding to the deficit, which it probably will eventually. But the point is, you know, there is movement here. That's positive in my view. You know, what this package looks like, I mean, you really have to you know, stare it in its face and see, you know, what actually is provided, you know, what other stipulations are added that people might object to. So I think there's a slightly clearer path, but I'm not ready to raise a victory flag that or maybe a checkered flag and call this a finish of the race here. I'd still like to see what's in the final package that is right. Proposed by Speaker Johnson, then, you know, whether that has a shot in getting through the House. And I suppose the other part is whether or not Trump raises an objection to this, which is always a potential, and that throws it off track again. So we are getting to a stage, you know, I firmly believe if you don't get this done in April, it's going to be increasingly difficult, you know, the closer you get to the election in 2024. But the other point is just the relevance of this to Ukraine's defense. Right. You know, there have been some interesting developments on both sides. You know, my guys at Rokon Consulting were their kind of final missive on the publication that they've been issuing every week on Ukraine was that, you know, watch out in May and June when the Russians may yet, you know, the weather conditions are going to allow for a larger offensive. And I think, you know, the Ukrainians can be in a tough time in May or April, in May or June, an appropriations package. Right. You know, you can still backfill some stuff that might be sent over to Ukraine on an emergency basis, but we really are getting, you know, closer and closer to a midnight hour here.
You know, Russia has used the Crocus Concert Hall attack in Moscow as an, you know, opportunity to blame this act of ISIS-K terrorism on Ukrainians, and then demanded the extradition of senior intelligence and other leaders, accusing him of terrorism, which Kyiv's reply was, wow, it takes some nerve to be the terrorist state that's bombing civilians, whether in Kharkiv, Kyiv, depriving a million people of electricity and heat. It's still cold there, is extraordinary. The good news is Speaker Johnson has said that the United States will do the right thing on this, which is where Michael Herson of American Defense International, who joins us every Friday, has made clear that that's where the speaker's head has been. He's just trying to navigate this. And the good news is that the minority leader, Hakeem Jeffries, has said that the Democrats would not participate in an effort to oust him as they did Kevin McCarthy, and a lot more respect for Johnson than there was for McCarthy, in part because Democrats feel like McCarthy betrayed them on that big, broader budget deal. From your standpoint, if the supplemental does not happen, what are its industrial base implications, given that that supplemental measure is what includes funding now that has been repeatedly delayed to get U.S. weapons production back on
Well,
track?
that's a really interesting aspect of this. I mean, I suppose it's kind of what Senator Reid, chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, had alluded to. I think it was about 2 weeks ago at a media breakfast that, you'd really have to start looking at the FY25 budget, and that would entail potentially breaking the caps. But yet again, it'll be Congress having to make the case, to do that. And so you're back into another, budget round and navigating the FY25 budget through this year. Again, it's an election year. So, is this something that could get done before the November election? Is it done, in 2025? It's just another layer of uncertainty. And I think, absolutely agree to your point that, this is not just about Ukraine. It is about it ultimately about Taiwan, and also, a critical factor is the submarine industrial base, which I assume and hope that we hear a lot about at next week's Sea Air Space Show.
Indeed, and we'll talk a little bit about that in a moment. One of the other notes that you wrote, you said thoughts to ponder on the Russo-Ukrainian war. Walk the audience through your thesis.
Well, there are a couple of things, and it was really spawning to events and some other indicators that I thought were intriguing. I mentioned Rokan Consulting had been publishing this Ukraine conflict monitor. I get this every week. It's like 30 pages. It's very, very detailed on what's going on in the war. These guys are based in Krakow. I think they've got pretty good relationships, particularly in Ukraine. But basically they said they're discontinuing publication of this. The March 23rd, March 30th issue was the last one to be published. And I thought, that's just kind of a classic contrary indicator. When people start to lose interest in this, and like most of these events, it's episodic, but it gets overtaken by the war in Israel, by US domestic events, by bad weather in the Midwest, so I can understand that. But I just thought it was an intriguing contrary indicator that, okay, if interest is kind of popularly falling off in this, you could all be surprised. Maybe going back to the comment I made a couple of minutes ago about May, June being a potential point for another major offensive push is one indicator. The other thing, and you referenced it, was the ISIS-K attack on Crocus City Hall, that venue. I just wonder, there are other issues to think about. If ISIS-K is going to be a bigger factor within Russia security, does that mean they've got to pull resources and focus on ISIS-K? What does it mean for European and Central Asian security if ISIS-K is really resurging here? And there's an interesting question about, Muslim minorities in Russia, which I think there have been some reports that they were being targeted. Did they then head back to some of the Central Asian states that they'd come from? How does that affect Russian military capacity? So, does this embolden Putin to try and get the Ukraine situation squared away as quickly as possible, or he would escalate because he now has potentially a domestic terror issue on his hands? So I just kind of want to put that out there. And I also think, There's still a very basic and important fundamental question that I don't see a lot written about. I'm sure there are a lot of intelligence assessments that we just don't see, but at least from a think tank kind of popular media coverage, what's Russia's military going to look like? Call it 2025 to 2030. CSBA did release a report called basically, more of the same, the future of Russia military and its ability to change. That basically said they have shown a capacity to change in the past, but it really wasn't conclusive in where Russia's military could go or what it could look like in 28 and 29 when they've absorbed possibly the lessons of Ukraine. I guess an underlying assumption is that Putin or someone like Putin would still be in power. But I don't see their domestic military capacity to do things like, crank out tanks or combat aircraft at the levels that they were able to do during the Cold War. There's Russia is not the Soviet Union. So what do they do? What's that threat look like and how does it change? Do they double down on drones and UAVs? Do they look like more like the Iranian military? Those kind of questions are going to bear on how Europe perceives its defense, how the US also shapes its contingencies for a conflict involving Russia. And I just find it a really interesting question that that military and business planners should be thinking about. And I'm sure they
Do you,
do. Go ahead.
well, do you think that the revelations that Russia is behind the Havana Syndrome attacks that have been happening all around the world, 60 Minutes, Der Spiegel, and The Insider, the organization, open source news organization that led by Christo Grozhev, the investigative reporter that used to work with Alexei Navalny, basically laid out that the Russians really, in fact, are at war with us.
They are.
That on every front, the Russians are involved and are using this, directed energy microwave technology on incapacitating the very counterintelligence officers that are investigating Russia. I mean, at the end of the day, and the US government unfortunately appears to have suppressed this for a variety of reasons, in part because they don't know what to do. But that doesn't, I mean, at what point do you need to drive a change here in our behavior? I mean, Israel reached out, yesterday and struck Iranians in Syria, Iranian, Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps commanders who had their fingers in everything from aiding Hamas to Hezbollah to the Houthis, and finally took them out. Whether you want to debate that escalates it or not, it would appear that the United States really isn't
Well,
escalating.
we
Real
aren't,
quick
and
take on
there,
both of those.
there's a part of the political spectrum in the United States that frankly supports Putin. That's the same part of the political spectrum that looks fondly at what Hungary is doing these days. And so, there's that element to it. I suppose the other part is it's a balance of risk, Fago. Russia is still a nuclear-armed state, and I suppose anything that we would do that could threaten them from an existential standpoint could really have some very drastic consequences. Having said that, there are a lot of things you can do that are well below that level of existential threat, and yeah, I would think that there's not a recognition that Russia is kind of a mortal enemy, not the way there was during the Cold War, when it was the Soviet Union. I think there may be that, the McCain characterization, I forget his exact words, but Senator McCain used to call it a heavily armed gas station or a nuclear armed gas station or something. I mean, just kind of like, yeah,
Right.
there's Russia, but it's kind of this poor, country that has a lot of natural resources, but they're not really a big threat. And when in fact, it's not just look at the poisonings that are going on, or they killed this Ukrainian defector in Spain. I mean, they do have a reach here, and their ability to export that, I think, maybe you need a mass casualty event or something that would really just, infrastructure being dropped or utility power plants being taken offline from a cyber attack, where people, like, if it affects people's daily lives, then they really get jumpy about this, or it's some spectacular event like 9/11 that just galvanizes a national response. But we're not there yet. We're not there yet in the United States, and maybe we won't get there. Maybe the Russians are smart enough to also operate below that threshold.
We're going to go into a little bit of a lightning round. Does Israel's strike in Syria against the Iranians change the dimension? I mean, if you were weighing risk calculations, how would you be weighing them at this point? Right? Because both sides have tried to avoid a direct confrontation. But, if you're Israel, it's a pretty legitimate target to take out the commanders that are the fingers behind a lot of your woes on two important fronts.
Well, the question is, you had that kind of show of force by the US and Iran when Soleimani was taken out, and Iran was able to strike at a US bases with a missile attack in Iraq that potentially could have been more catastrophic had they actually killed a number of US service people. I don't know, Vago, if Iran tries that same strike to, gain honor in this, how the Israelis would respond. And you can argue, well, this was really triggered by a missile attack on a lot. I'm talking about the Israeli action in Damascus. It was
Right.
triggered by a missile strike in a lot. So, I'm just not close enough to how Iran sees this. There's been a low-level war going on in Syria for years now between Iran, its proxies, and Israel. So, but do they see this as something that's so escalatory and so dramatic that they have to respond in a way that notches this up? Or do we just, is it going to be like the things we've been seeing in Syria for years now? I can't say. I mean, I just think, you have a set of dice and you roll them every day for this one.
Indeed. Let me take you to Hudson event last week on unmanned systems. Brian Clark of Hudson will be joining us this week on the Air Power Show to discuss the findings from that report. Walk us through what jumped out at you as particularly interesting to devote an entire note to.
Well, I think it was just the fact you typically don't hear from General Atomics. They are a private company. And I think, it's just nice to hear them kind of air out who are they, what do they do, how do they approach the world. At a time they do some very interesting and innovative things that are accorded to them because they are a private company. And again, Vago, I think it highlights this tension that I continue to see between large public companies that are kind of, worshiping at the altar of shareholder value, and smaller private companies that don't have to buy back stock or meet quarterly earnings estimates. I mean, look, they still have to earn a return on investment. They still are, profit-seeking organizations. But I think General Atomics' ability to take bets, to invest, it's going to be fascinating to see if this is in fact rewarded in the collaborative combat aircraft or some of the other things that General Atomics is pursuing. So I'm glad that they get out they should probably do it more often. It's just to kind of raise their profile. I mean, their defense customers know who they are, but the broader defense ecosystem, people in Congress, even people within the industry. I mean, I just think it's a pretty interesting there are other companies too, that have been around for a long time. Sierra Nevada is one that comes to mind. And then, of course, you have the whole round of defense startups, Anduril, Shield AI. They're kind of thinking along the same lines. It's not to say that the large defense contractors can't be innovative. We talked about the HAI Investor Day, kind of what they're doing, between a kind of traditional shipbuilding business model and their acquisitions, notably Alion, and how they're really trying to push things forward by frankly taking a bit of risk and applying technology. But it's just a nice counter narrative to, oh, we just borrowed $12 billion to buy back stock.
What I find interesting is the entire innovation agenda that Dr. Carter launched was based on frustration with the primes, largely. And then it was, hey, let's bring new people into the business, where there are actually quite a sizable group of companies that are highly innovative, are in the industrial base, but attention goes to sort of the newer firms from Silicon Valley that are seen as sexier and faster moving, where the ecosystem already has a number of companies that are very, very innovative if they were just given the opportunity to, to land some of those contracts. And unfortunately, right, the bigger the prime, the bigger the ability to buy into contracts, whether it's MQ25. I know that that stung, General Atomics, that had worked very, very hard on helping define that requirement and get the program started. And indeed, in this case, right, the company has been in the vanguard, and obviously they're one of our sponsors, but
I
have
think the other
been
thing that Alexander,
shaping collaborative combat aircraft, and now the Air Force looks like it's allowing companies to buy in, right? So we can sort of see where this might unfortunately be going again.
well, but I think the other thing that, Brian kind of started the interview off with Dave Alexander about, so where are we? Are we kind of at this tipping point? And Dave said, yeah, I think we are at a tipping point where you really are seeing the services to move out with more autonomous systems. And that's just not the system, that's the networks in which those systems operate. So CCA is kind of the marquee one on that, but they've talked about some really interesting things as well in Navy that are going on, and the Army has some as well too. So it's just it was a good interview. As I said, I would hope that Dave would get on stage more often and kind of show their stuff. Because to your point, yeah, people pay attention to the startups and the new guys. They pay attention to the startups and the traditional primes, but they don't always, these companies that have been around for a while, like Sierra Nevada, like General Atomics, I think don't always get their time in the sun.
AeroVironment being another one of those companies that is just
Absolutely.
incredibly innovative, and has demonstrated an ability to scale whenever needed, right? I mean, so that's not necessarily just the purview of Silicon Valley companies, even if they're bringing something to the equation. And the piece that Brian is joining us tomorrow for, excuse me, on Thursday's Air Power Conversation, is on their new hedging strategy and the role of unmanned systems in that. And Hudson's been, and Brian and Dan Pat and the whole team there have been doing some terrific work. Let me take you, and we should have also said, right, unmanned systems and the way the Ukrainians are using it to assert sea power in the Black Sea is another great example where, Ukraine is emerging as a naval power without any warships and actually putting the hurt on the Russian Black Sea fleet.
Yeah, and
To
Vardo,
then,
I just want to say one other thing because I think it's fascinating. I read some commentary about, drones versus good old self-propelled artillery, and this particular individual was making some really, I think, very valid comments that, these systems aren't going to displace some of these traditional weapons like self-propelled artillery. I mean, this guy was making the case that, look, you've got slower flight times. You've got a much smaller mass from drones. They're clearly a part of the Ukrainian war, and I think very you can't operate without them. But I don't think that they're going to replace self-propelled artillery or rocket artillery in ground force inventories. And you've talked about this in the Red Sea battles against Houthi drones, that it's good old 5-inch naval guns that are also playing a pretty important role in downing these things. So, you have to be careful about assuming that we're going to transition completely from one to the other. I'd say the same thing is going to be true for manned aircraft. We're going to continue to have manned aircraft, but they are going to be complemented by these autonomous systems, and that's the really intriguing thing to watch.
Indeed. And to build on that, I want to just go to a news item that broke yesterday. Hanwha has been trying to buy Austal Ocean for some time and has made a cash offer for the company. Today, you put out a note on that. Walk us through the impact and implications of a potential deal. Hanwha has increasingly becoming a global company. Really has some extraordinary technologies. I mean, they have a tendency of bringing the K9 Thunder, which is one of the world's best artillery pieces, to AUSA. But what I think is actually more interesting is just the sheer vast array of technology the company has, everything from space communications to unmanned systems to air systems, undersea systems. What does this do for that dynamic equation at a time when Austal, you know, is rounding the bend on the Independence class? I mean, the last of them is going to be delivered, I think, this year, right? So yeah. Well, walk us through what this deal means.
You know, Austal, I'm sure, you know, the two Chris's are going to talk about this too. But look, it's been floating around for a while. I think, you know, there have been multiple stories about Austal, you know, entertaining new ownership. You know, I guess what broke last night was kind of, you know, an Australian, it was a disclosure that Austal had to make about Hanwha and, you know, making a cash offer. And it popped the Austal stock in Australian trading, which is where it's listed. You know, it's fascinating, Vago, because on one hand, you go, oh, you know, foreign ownership of the U.S. shipyard. Well, you know, Fincantieri owns shipyards up in Wisconsin, where the Constellation-class frigate is being built. The, you know, BAE Systems does a lot of service and support work in various yards around the United States. So this idea that, and Halter Marine, I think, have been owned by a Singaporean company, ST Dynamics. So I just find this, I don't have any insider view on how the Australians are going to view South Korean ownership of Austal. I was intrigued, and I called this out in my note, that, you know, the Secretary of the Navy had been in both South Korea and Japan at the end of February, beginning of March, visiting shipyards there. Now, I think his purpose was really to see, like, hey, what could he learn? But also, could these shipyards help in supporting U.S. naval ships in the Indo-Pacific with maintenance repair services? And I think just to learn about it. But it might make sense. You know, I don't think, clearly it would have to clear a CFIUS review, but I don't think people should shy away from South Korean potential ownership of the Austal facilities in the United States, principally the yard in Mobile, Alabama, particularly if they're going to put more cash, not that Austal hasn't been investing in their yard as things go. So, you know, but I think the other broader message was, you know, Hanwha, the other South Korean defense companies, KAI, you know, they have become a bigger force in global defense markets. And I see this as just another, you know, kind of pronouncement of another step that Hanwha has taken to build their global footprint. And that's a significant long-term change that's taking place in global defense.
It is, and I should have also pointed out that you know, Hanwha landed significant deals, especially in Poland. But Byron, you know, a lightning round here. You noted tangential factors on the Francis Scott Key Bridge collapse. Yeah. Give us your sense on that, and I want to get your take on what to expect at Navy League, and then do the week ahead and end the program.
Look, I think, you know, Francis Scott Key Bridge, the president is going to be there on Friday. You know, we're going to see the usual pushback on another emergency supplemental, where the pay for is going to go to. It kind of goes back to, I think, what we're seeing out of Speaker Johnson is, as much as people in the Freedom Caucus are going to raise this, I think we're going to get more money for Francis Scott Key Bridge. You know, well, the way we've gotten money for all these natural disasters and events, it raises some interesting broader questions about, you know, what's the rest of port infrastructure look like in the United States? The fact that these container ships and other merchant ships have gotten bigger and bigger and bigger, and infrastructure is in order to handle them, is a really fascinating subtext. But again, you know, where's the money come from? How who repairs that? How long does it take? And you know, the fact that, come on, Baltimore port, it's an election year. You know, there are going to be competitive races in Maryland and Pennsylvania. So I think the idea that no one's going to leave Baltimore to hang out to dry in this kind of political period.
interesting and trenchant indeed, right? Politics, how surprising. I should also note that Francis Scott Key is a 1796 graduate of St. John's College in Annapolis. So just pointing that out. He's a true Marylander. Navy League, you mentioned submarine industrial base spending. What are some other themes you're interested in pursuing and hope to hear from Navy
Look,
leaders this year?
I think, one is okay. If I look at the budget justification books, the next generation new attack submarine and the next generation destroyer were pushed out. So what are the plans for the existing fleet? What do you need to think about extending the life of some of the Virginia class subs, and what does it mean for your existing DDG fleet? The autonomy picture is always going to be really important. What's Navy going to say about that? The FAXX program was also pushed out. So how is the Navy, thinking about their own CCA type platform? Are there options? Are there companies that are going to be bringing potential solutions to that? Recognizing that operating something like that off a carrier, is very different than operating it off a land base, but they do have MQ-25, and that's in its own right can be a pretty interesting platform. And you look at the volume of what it could carry. So, there aren't a lot of competitions. There is a submarine tender that's actually a pretty big program. I think each of these ships is over $1 billion, and it's just one of those foundational needs the Navy has to have. Submarine tenders for its submarine fleet. And I think the existing boats are probably, what, 30, 40 years old at least. So that's going to be, from a competitive standpoint, that's what I'll spend a little bit of time poking around on.
Terrific. And walk us through the week ahead. What should the audience be paying attention to?
Look, we talked about that security supplemental. What else could be talked about that? There is a NATO foreign ministers meeting in Brussels this week. See what comes out of that related to Ukraine. There are always a couple of think tank events. The General Cavoli, the U.S. commander, European command is going to be speaking at CSIS on Friday, and there are just a couple of others. I think. There's an AUSA event with Army leadership. So, these kind of backfills, Russ Rumbaugh of Assistant Secretary of the Navy is going to be speaking at AEI. Kind of is there more color on the FY25 budget and maybe some of these unfunded priority lists that keep getting dribbled out. I think we've seen most of those, but the National Guard request for F-15EXs was kind of intriguing in its own right. But again, these lists, they didn't really matter in FY24 and FY25, unless Congress is willing to break the caps significantly. It's hard to see where you get another 20 or $25 billion, whatever these unfunded lists are adding up to.
Byron, thanks so very much for joining us. Always a pleasure. Hope you have a great week, and we'll see you next Monday when we get back to regular order. Thanks so much again.
Thanks a lot, Fargo. Cheers.
Thanks very much to all of you for tuning in today. Before we go, a quick word from our sponsors. The Defense and Aerospace Report and its family of publications is brought to you by HII, General Atomics Aeronautical Systems, GE Aerospace, Bell, Leonardo DRS, American Rheinmetall, and TE Connectivity. We'll be back again tomorrow with Sam Bendett of the Center for Naval Analyses with the latest on the Ukraine war. We'll see you again tomorrow. Until then, have a great day.